Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
If you would, please be turning to the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. We're going to be spending some time this evening in Nehemiah, specifically in chapter 2. Just a quick note, as we announced this morning, we do have these available. These are booklets that are meant to act as a guide for us in several different ways over the next few months. We do have some extras that are in the Welcome Center, and so if you did not pick one up this morning, we're going to start out just doing one per family until everyone gets one, and then maybe we can have some extras that are there we can hand out after that. But I just wanted to really briefly just go over what we have planned for us to do together. And there won't be a test on this. You're not required to do any of this. This is just an opportunity we have as a congregation. The idea is that we will have a specific way every day, every week, every month, and every quarter that we can grow spiritually. This time of year, we make a lot of New Year's resolutions, and one of the temptations is to just say, well, I'm going to do this more or do this better. I'm going to eat healthier. I'm going to exercise more. But the temptation with that is not to have anything concrete. And so we really wanted to have just some concrete ways that we could grow and just some opportunities. And so we're going to have daily readings, one chapter from the New Testament each weekday, and then the weekend will give you time to catch up if you're behind in your reading. Every week, a Graymere member has written a devotional article, and what that's designed for our families to have a weekly devotional. And that's our challenge, especially our challenge to the men of our families as spiritual leaders, to take the initiative and just have a time where you read through that article together, where you pray about what the scripture has focused you on, you ask that discussion question, and don't get caught up with how long it might be, but the important thing is the family comes together and has a devotional time once a week. That's a goal that we've set, and then a monthly memory verse that we're going to seek to memorize together as a congregation. And so we'll go over this month in just a moment. And then each quarter, there's a book that's going to focus on that quarter's theme that we've selected. If you want to kind of get together in a bulk rate, we can purchase that. The book that we're going to be looking at this quarter is called Capture the Courage. It's written by Scott Gleaves, who preached for the Grainy White congregation and is now teaching at Faulkner University. But we can get together. There'll be a list next week in the Welcome Center to, if you want to sign up and get a copy of this for a reduced price of $10.50, we can come together, and that can just be something you can have to read as your own personal resource. It's a study of Acts chapters 1 through 12. As we think about serving God with all our heart, there's not a better place to go to see people who are willing to give all they had to the Lord. And so these are just ways that we can continue to grow, and hopefully, as we grow spiritually, we're going to be thinking not only how we can grow, but how we can encourage others to do the same. And so we're very excited. There's also a calendar in there that'll give you updates on what to be praying for and what to be thinking about as we go throughout this year. As we announced, our theme is going to be focusing on loving God with all of our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength. And there are a couple of songs that have been, I guess, relatively new songs that help us focus on that. And one is Lord, Take Control. And I thought it would be appropriate today as we think about our theme before we go through our lesson together that we sing this together. If you know it, sing out. If not, it's an easy song to learn with a beautiful message. My heart, my mind, my body, my soul, I give to you, take control. I give my body a living sacrifice. Lord, take control, take
take control. My heart, my mind, my body, my soul, I give to you. Take control. I give my body a living sacrifice. Lord, take control. Take control.
It's a beautiful song that reminds us of our theme. And of course, as we think about our theme and our verse for this month, if you look at this next slide, this is the verse we're wanting to memorize this month. And our Pew Packers group starts back officially next Sunday at 4:40. And we're going to be memorizing this verse. And so if you don't memorize it, you may be shown up by some of your young children that are learning that. So as we think about this verse that we're memorizing, let's just, as we work on doing this, if you would say this with me and we'll try to kind of ingrain that in our minds. We'll begin right after the phrase, "And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love the neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets." We're going to be thinking about that this month. Let's try to ingrain that in our mind. If you've already opened to Nehemiah chapter 2, we're going to get there in just a moment. You may have heard the expression, I'm sure you've probably heard it used, about someone who marches to the beat of a different drummer. That phrase came home to me in a whole new way my sophomore year of high school. Because my sophomore year in high school, I normally played alto saxophone in the band, but we needed some extra percussionist, and so I got recruited. And so I was back there, and I was trying to learn how to play the different percussion instruments. But I noticed something different when you're in the percussion section at the back of the band. There would be times when we would be so caught up in looking at our music, and we were trying to make sure we were hitting all the right notes and doing everything where we were supposed to, that we weren't looking at the conductor. And we'd look up and we'd realize that we had sort of been setting a beat, we'd been setting a tempo, but we were totally off of what he was trying to direct. And usually, he'd be glaring at us by the time we looked up, and he'd be pointing to his baton, and we'd try to get back in tempo and rhythm with him. But what happens when that takes place is that you have this tug of war, where those that were closer to the conductor were trying to stay with him, and those that were at the back near us and hearing us being off tempo and going at a different pace would try to stay with us. And so there's this tug of war, because it's obvious when you're getting together in a band to play a musical piece, there can only be one tempo. There can only be one conductor. There's only one set pace that you can go at. And when Jesus would talk about our lives, he would give us that same principle when he described what it's like in Matthew 6 and verse 24, saying, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will love the one and hate the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." In other words, there can only be one tempo. There can only be one cadence for my life. And that might sound obvious to us. But as the drumbeat of the world can grow so loud in our ears that we often lose sight of what God wants us to do, there's a little tug of war that takes place. And we find ourselves caught in the middle, trying to decide, well, who am I going to listen to? Or who am I going to follow? Who's setting the pace? Who's setting the tone for my life? And so this evening, we're going to look at an example of someone who, in a very real way, marched to a different drummer, marched to a different beat in his day. Someone who was living with a specific purpose. And his purpose was different than those around him. But because he had a very specific purpose, he was living on purpose, as we're thinking of. And because he had that very specific set of instructions for his life and devotion in his spirit, he was able to do things that seemed rather impossible. And so when we come on Nehemiah, beginning in chapter 2, verse 1, if you would read with me, if Nehemiah has already heard about what's taking place in Jerusalem, the fact that the city lays in ruins, and he has already had in his heart and spent time in prayer about his desire to go and to lead this rebuilding effort. Nehemiah is the cupbearer of the king, which, while it's still the task of a servant, was not a menial task. This was a good position for someone of Nehemiah's background to be in. And yet he still wants to go back and to be part of this rebuilding effort. So we begin in verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 2. And it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when this city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, "If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Now we'll stop right there and consider what happens as Nehemiah walks into what seems to be an impossible situation. The first impossible situation we see him encounter takes place in a throne room. A throne room can be an intimidating place. We might remember what it was like for Esther when she was going to go before the king, knowing that as she was going to set into motion a series of events that would ultimately lead in the right for the Jewish people to defend themselves against a decree that had already been set, she knew that if she walked before the presence of the king and he didn't extend that scepter, that she could lose more than just her own pride. There was more than just her pride or sense of embarrassment that was at risk. It was her life that was at risk. Throne room can be intimidating. We might think of the prophet Nathan when he was going before David and he was telling them this story about a man who had a pet lamb. And David is so caught up in this story and the seeming injustice, but Nathan knows he has to tell David that he is the one who has done what's wrong. And he has to confront him about his sin with Bathsheba and ultimately a sin that led to Uriah being killed. Throne rooms can be intimidating. We might think about Daniel standing before the king and facing up to him saying he wants to stay on a different diet. He wants to preserve who he is and his identity. These can be very intimidating places. And even though Nehemiah had a good position, in fact, it would have been quite a prominent position, one for him to be proud of, not being one of a Persian heritage that has this role of being cupbearer before the king, he's still in a situation that seems impossible. Up until this point, he had not been sad in the presence of the king. And that's important, because it was usually a good idea for your own self-preservation not to be sad in the presence of the king. It was important to be in a good mood. People were not often sad in the king's presence. Now, the king often would, from what we can see here, just the way he views Nehemiah, it seems very clear that he's concerned about Nehemiah, about his countenance, which makes sense. Because if the role of a cupbearer is to make sure that what's set before the king is fit to be consumed and make sure nothing's poisonous, you are going to be very concerned with how your cupbearer looks. And so it's very clear to him that Nehemiah is sad. And did you notice that when he finds out that Nehemiah is sad in verse 2, he says at the end, "Then I was very much afraid." He's in the presence of the king, and the king's giving him an opportunity to explain his disposition, to explain why he has the attitude he does. There's a door that's open. Nehemiah is about to walk through it. And in this situation, he was very afraid. And as we think about what it would be like to be in the throne room, we can imagine those emotions. And then we find out in verse 4 that he prays just before responding to the king. It's important to remember this is not the first time that Nehemiah has prayed about this whole situation. This is not a situation he rushed into and then said a quick prayer before he made this proposal to the king. When we read through chapter 1, we see there was a period of time where Nehemiah was spending that time in prayer and thinking about what was going to happen and praying about that. And so if I'm thinking in terms of my life, it's good for me to say a quick prayer before something happens. I had a friend that a few years ago that told me about the practice he had of just when someone was coming into his office, just to have a meeting or a conversation, he would say a quick prayer for that person. That's a great thing to do. But we also don't need to lose sight of the preparation of prayer that had taken place before that. This was not the first time Nehemiah had brought this before the throne of God. And so he was, because of that, was ready for a plan when the opportunity presented itself. He had a chance. And who knows how many chances he would have to really make a fully fleshed out plan and before the king and make his pitch as to why he should go back and to be able to be part of this rebuilding mission. And so because he had a plan in mind, he was able to jump on this opportunity. I used to think as I was growing up that I would never want to listen to talk radio. I couldn't imagine why anyone would listen to talk radio. I wanted to listen to music on the radio. That's what you listen to. And now I listen to talk radio. So I don't know if that means I'm officially an adult or what. But one of the things you'll notice on talk radio, especially tomorrow, as there have been so many football games played today, it's easy to tune in and talk radio. And I enjoy doing this and listening to people try to diagram what's happened. But have you noticed how easy it is to be an expert about what happened in a football game or what happened in an election after the fact? It's easy to come up with a plan of what should have happened or how something should have gone. It's not hard to come up with a plan after the fact, but it's important to have a plan in place when the opportunity presents itself. And that's what Nehemiah does. He has a plan ready. And so when the king asks him what he wants, he's able to ask in a specific way to make his request. And so here's his request as we continue a reading in verse 5. He said, "If your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Then the king said in verse 6, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. So he's asking for a specific amount of time off. And then in verse 7, "I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go." And the king granted them to me because the good hand of my God was on me. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. I want us to stop right there just to see all of the different requests that Nehemiah makes of the king. He had a very specific plan. Nehemiah 13 and verse 6, when we compare that to the timing we're given at the beginning of the book, it seems that there was about a time span of 12 years that was needed for Nehemiah to accomplish his purpose. Can you imagine going into your supervisor at work and saying, "I need some time off"? Well, how long? Well, maybe a decade, give or take a couple of years. Need about 12 years off. Can you imagine what that would have been, especially for Nehemiah and his station in life? And he asked to rebuild the city. What's interesting is when we look in Ezra chapter 4, we find out that Artaxerxes himself had stopped construction years earlier. He was given correspondence from people in the area, and so he sends out this letter, and this is the way it reads in Ezra 4, verses 19 through 21. "A decree has been issued by me, and a search has been made, and it has been discovered that the city has risen up against the kings in past days, that rebellion and revolt have been perpetuated in it, that mighty kings have ruled over Jerusalem, governing the provinces beyond the river, and that tribute, custom, and toll were paid to them. So now issue a decree to make these men stop work, that this city may not be rebuilt until a decree is issued by me." And so Nehemiah tells the king, "I want to go back and rebuild that city." Can you imagine what that would have been like? Can you understand why Nehemiah might have been afraid when he's standing before him? He was asking to rebuild a city that was already thought it might have been a problem. There might have been a political motive there for Artaxerxes to build it back, but it still would have been hard to ask for this kind of action. And he wanted letters of authority from the king, sort of making him an ambassador. And he was not someone who was naturally born as a part of this kingdom. And so he wanted to be like an ambassador. He wanted to have soldiers with him. Not only that, but he wanted timber from the king's forest to go back and to rebuild here. Now, it's hard for us to imagine the audacity it would take to make that kind of claim. So let's think about it this way. We don't have a monarchy in the same way that they did. But just imagine that you were a personal aide to the President of the United States, that you have an office that's right in front of the entrance to the Oval Office, that you're at your desk, and one day as the president is walking by you, he notices that you're looking unhappy. He asks you about it. And you tell him that the area where you came from has been deserted, it's been in ruins, and you want to go back and to rebuild it. And he says, okay, what do you need? Now just imagine you're standing before the President of the United States, and you say, I need some time off. I need 12 years off. You know that foreign policy you decided on a few years ago? I need you to reverse that. I also need to be appointed an ambassador in that area, and I need to have official letters to let them know I'm there on your behalf. Not only that, I need some of your officers to go with me. We'll need materials to build the wall since I don't have any of my own, so I need you to underwrite that. If you could give me some of your timber, I could take it with me and use to build up a city in a different country. I would appreciate it. I know that you previously thought that having that city fortified would really help the competition, but I plan on doing that, and I'm going to use your materials to do it. Can you imagine how that would have seemed? And yet constantly, if we look throughout the chapter, we see that God's hand is on Nehemiah. There are so many places in which we see Nehemiah going through and giving the glory and the credit to God as the one who's working in this situation. It seemed to be impossible, but God is at work. Notice the fact that as he prays to the God of heaven in verse 4, and then we scan down here to verse 8, he says, the king granted them to me, these requests, because the good hand of my God was on me. And then as we go through and we see, as he's going to inspect Jerusalem's walls once he gets there, he's going to continue to be looking for God's will in an impossible situation. He's there in the throne room, but because he's ready, because he's prayed about his mission and he's ready to step up, he meets that challenge. And so then he goes to Jerusalem and he finds out as soon as he gets there that the leaders are against him. Let's continue reading in Nehemiah chapter 2 and we'll see exactly how they responded to him. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. And I rose in the night, and I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. Again, he's referring to what God has set in his mind to do. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the Dragon's Well, and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. In other words, there wasn't a clear enough place for him to be able to go through. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, or the officials, or the rest who did the work. Then I said to them, you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And notice in verse 18, he points back to what God has done. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. What Nehemiah was able to do was point to the way in which God was with him. And when they saw that God was with him, and when they saw that he had a vision for what needed to be done in a situation that must have seemed impossible, they were ready to get up and build. Can you imagine what it would have been like for a place to be so desolate, in such ruins, that you couldn't even pass through on a horse or a donkey in certain areas, that there was so much rubble everywhere? And yet when Nehemiah looked at that, he was looking at what God's plan would be. It was an impossible situation in the throne room, and it would have seemed impossible when he got to Jerusalem. Yet he had this vision for what God could do. Now, vision is a catchword these days. We hear about it a lot, we read about it a lot. In leadership literature, we're thinking about vision, and many of those things are good principles for us to have. But first and foremost, Nehemiah's vision was God's vision for what needed to be done. He was giving credit to God all the way and looking for God's guidance throughout this entire process. And it makes a difference. He was able to look at the ruins that were there in Jerusalem and be able to see what God could accomplish. And so I asked myself, got a whole year before me, 2012, and I look at my own Christian life. Do I have a clear vision of what God could accomplish in my life this year? Now, obviously, when I say that, I'm not meaning to exclude myself from any work. We know that as we grow spiritually, it's going to take effort on our part. But anything good that happens is going to come by God working through us. So do I have a vision for what my life could look like this time next year in 2013? Will I be closer to God? Will I have shown His love in real and concrete ways to others? Will I know more about His Word? Will I have shared His Word with someone else? Will I have a better prayer life? Do I have a vision for what I would be like a year from now? And do we as a congregation have a vision for what we could be as a congregation this time next year? For what we could do as a congregation, not to puff ourselves up or to try to have some kind of reputation that exalts ourselves, but what could we do for the Lord? If we have Nehemiah's attitude and if we make that our own, do we have a vision for what God could do in this community? Can we think of people, specific individuals that could be reached by us sharing God's Word, God's love, compassion to them? Can we think of concrete ways that could happen? Are there ways we could reach out to members of this congregation that are in need, maybe physically or even just spiritually, in need of a friendship or a connection to the congregation? Is there a need that we can meet? Do I have a vision for what can happen? It's interesting to read what Stephen Covey discovered with a survey a few years ago of 23,000 U.S. residents who were employed full-time within key industries in key areas. And here are some of the findings when it came to the vision of their organization. Only 37% said they had a clear understanding of what their organization was trying to achieve. Only 1 in 5 was enthusiastic about their organization's goals. Only 1 in 5 said they had a clear line of sight between what they were doing and the goals of the organization. Only 15% felt that they were able to execute their goals, that they had the responsibility or the power to do it. And only 20% fully trusted the organization. Now, he compared that to a soccer team. If you're taking these numbers and comparing it to a soccer team, that 4 of the 11 players on the field would know which goal they were shooting at, and they'd be the only ones. Can you imagine a soccer game where only 4 of the 11 know which goal they're supposed to be aiming for? And all but 2 players would, in some way, be competing against their own team members rather than their opponent. Only 2 of the 11 would care which goal was theirs. And only 2 of the 11 would know what position they play and what exactly they're supposed to do. Obviously, there's no way that a soccer team could function that way. It shows us the importance of vision and an understanding how what I'm doing relates to that vision. And so again, we ask the question, do I understand the mission and goals that I'm involved in as a Christian, of serving God? Jesus came to seek and to save the lost, and I'm seeking to magnify His name. Do I understand how I'm doing that? And do I understand how what I am doing fits in to what the congregation as a whole is doing? And the way in which we're being led by God and by His Word and going down His path and accomplishing His will in our lives? If we don't understand that, we might need to stop and check that vision. And so as we ask ourselves those questions, do we have a vision for where we could be? Do we have a vision for how many people we could reach? Even when we look around this auditorium, do we have a vision for how many people who could be here in worship with us by this time next year? When we look around our community, do we have a vision for how many people could be reached or could be touched by the kindness that is shown by Christians and in very real ways see God's love? Do we have that vision for next year? A friend of mine recently told me about an effort that was begun by a couple of high school girls in Florence, Alabama, who had a conversation after a canned food drive at their school. They were amazed by how many people were in need of the canned food that was collected. And so they began a program together and with volunteers from each of their congregations called Handy Lunches that meets once a month and is a meals program for many of the homeless in that area. It's incredible to see how many people are touched and how many families have been touched just by the fact that 2 high school girls who are Christians got together and decided there's an issue and maybe we could serve in some way. They had a vision for what could happen. And time and time again, as we've been thinking about and talking about what's going to be on the calendar for this year and what we have lined up, I just want to make sure we're reminded of the fact we're not seeking to fill up a calendar with activities. We're not seeking just to find something to have each month of the year or each quarter of the year. We have specific goals in mind. Namely, we want to serve God in as many ways as possible. And these programs are not just things for us to do to feel good about ourselves, but they're ways that we can reach out to others. Do we have a vision of how we can be used in those areas to reach souls for Christ? It may be that we need to have a few conversations, much like they did, that said, here's an issue. I wonder what we could do. I wonder what kind of ministry could reach these individuals. I wonder what ways I can use the talents and abilities that I have to serve God. As we think about situations that seem impossible, it may be important to ask, are we facing something impossible? Nehemiah faced it in the throne room. He faced it in Jerusalem. And yet as we read through the book of Nehemiah, it's amazing to see the way God works through His people. And so tonight, I want to ask you, are you facing something that seems impossible? A problem that it seems you'll never be able to surmount. Something you'll never be able to get over. And I love the way when Jesus is describing this issue in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 26, He introduces the statement, with God all things are possible, by saying this, with people this is impossible. I may very well be facing something that seems impossible to me. With people, it might be impossible. But with God, all things are impossible. I've just got to be living according to His purpose, and not the purposes that might be competing for my attention, the drumbeats that might be vying for my allegiance. I need to be following the one true leader, living according to His one purpose. Tonight, if you want to make that purpose your own, if you want to come forward, if you want to put Christ on in baptism and begin living according to that purpose, you can. Or it may be that you've done that and there's some other issue in your life, some other way that we can encourage you. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand and as we sing together.